Jung and Freud were colleagues for quite some time, both very instrumental in bringing forward the idea of the unconscious and unconscious factors that shape our way of being, thoughts, feelings, needs, past wounds, and how they shape our way of being in the world. Freud thought all of those are to be found in what he called the subconscious or the personal unconscious, which is the repository of all of our past experiences. Jung believed that that was true, but there's another layer of the unconscious that he called the collective unconscious, which consists of factors that are innate to us. We don't learn them necessarily. They're there. It's a given reality. It's the realm of what he came to call archetypes.
Welcome to Awakening Lives, a podcast of the Spirituality Network. We seek to cultivate the awakened life through contemplative living and action. Joining us today is Dick Sweeney. Dick, I am so excited to have you here. Why don't you share with our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you, Alejandro. I appreciate your invitation to talk with you and be present to your listeners this morning. I'll just give a little bit about myself and a little bit about my journey thus far. I currently live here in Southern Maine with my wife, Ellen. I work in practice as a Jungian analyst or a Jungian psychoanalyst. As is my wife, we actually met in Zurich when we were both in training over there over 30 years ago now.
Wow.
So, yeah. So we've been here in Maine just a little while, about a year and a half. Prior to that, we lived almost 30 years, 28 years in Columbus, Ohio. Got to know a lot of folks there and practiced there also as a Jungian analyst and also a spiritual director, which has something to do also with my past background before going to Zurich and meeting my wife, Ellen. I was a Roman Catholic priest for about 20 years in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, working in various capacities. One opportunity I was given during those years was to go study at a higher level, psychology and spirituality. My archbishop urged me to do that, and I certainly seized upon the opportunity. Went out to Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. It's a consortium of nine theology schools connected to University of California. And I went there because of the fact that it had so much diversity to offer. There were nine theology schools in a consortium. And there was a lot of emphasis on interdisciplinary study, and I was especially interested in psychology and spirituality. That's where I met the thought of Jung, which, of course, I'll try to say more about this morning. But eventually returned from those studies, taught 10 years at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Cincinnati, taught in spirituality, psychology, ethics. I went on to Zurich. That's when I made a midlife change of career, not really of career, but of situation, deciding to leave the active ministry and continue the work in a different fashion. So I'll just say, lastly, when we landed in Columbus in 1994, I pretty quickly became aware of the Spirituality Network. Met Noreen Malone and other such folks back then. And I ended up being on a committee of four that put together the first design for the Wellstreams Spiritual Direction Training Program. I recall certainly Sister Carol Ann Spencer, Maxine Schunk, Rick Bradley, and myself were involved in putting together at least the initial design. So I very much appreciate having made that contact with the Spirituality Network. So,
I was not aware of your connection there when we first talked. I was delighted to learn that because obviously Wellstreams had a huge impact on my own life, and I'm so grateful to get to talk with another one of the founders.
Yeah, gee, it kind of takes me back to be called a founder. I guess I'm old now. Yeah, but those were very interesting years, and
Yeah.
I really enjoyed my experiences there.
Well, I cannot wait to hear more about your perspectives on Jungian philosophies. I happened to run across a quote the other day that is particularly meaningful to me. I'm an Enneagram type 3. So I've lived much of my life adapting to other circumstances and to other people, feeling like I needed to do that in order to be able to fit in. And I ran across this quote that says, "The privilege of a lifetime is to become who you truly are." And I have really tried to embrace authenticity as a core value of mine, and I am finding it to be so life-giving to actually be myself and not be who I think I need to be to please people. So, I don't know if you have any reactions to that particular quote, or does it hold any special meaning for you?
Well, I mean, it certainly does hold special meaning. I think in some ways that quote is at the core of Jungian psychology as I see it. Because Jung talks about what he called individuation, which is an innate process that all of us find ourselves in. And individuation has to do with just what you described. It's moving toward authentic self-realization, which is a lifelong process. And it often means adjusting some of the ways of being we find ourselves into in the first half of life. Oftentimes, there is a good bit of accommodation, necessary accommodation in that first half of life, which is useful and helpful. But often around the mid years of life, we start to feel something else churning within us that's calling us to move in a direction that at that point feels more true, more significant, or just has much more psychic energy in it. And that's part of this movement toward greater individuation, which I can say more about more specifically as we proceed.
Yeah. So I'm curious. I have found this journey to being more authentic to be very engaging and uplifting and encouraging. I imagine for some that might be held with a little bit of fear or trepidation or angst because they've grown so accustomed to living life a certain way and to embrace a different way of life, even if more authentic, may be challenging for them.
Well, I certainly would agree with that. And I guess if I look at my own life, which is probably the best place to look for any of us, my own shift in mid years of life, so to speak, in my early 40s was challenging. As I mentioned before, I had been a priest for 20 years. And that had been a fairly meaningful, gratifying time where I enjoyed meeting a lot of people. Ministering in different ways, some counseling, some teaching, some working closely with archdiocese and administration. But I started to feel much more inner turbulence in my life in my early 40s, especially when I was out in Berkeley and had encountered Jung, and began to recognize aspects of myself that were unlived. Places where I had maybe over accommodated to the needs and expectations of others, and frankly, to the role of priest. And encountering that did create a good bit of turmoil, inner turmoil. I would have dreams of driving my car and colliding with lots of other cars and couldn't keep that from happening. I had one very big dream where I was standing by a seashore fishing, which I rarely ever did. And I pulled up out of the water a massive translucent fish that was about 100 times larger than myself. And when I pulled that up out of the water, everything changed. The water started moving in, knocked down a few huts that were on the beach at that point. And I slowly made my way back and climbed over the fence, following some unknown woman who seemed to know where I needed to go. In effect, the dream told me I had hooked into something much larger than I had anticipated, and which I would now certainly see as a movement of the spirit that was calling me toward some adjustment in my life that would honor, let's say, Eros relationship intimacy a bit more, that would leave enough place for debate, dissent, dialogue about religious points of view, and was maybe finding myself a bit fenced in my current circumstances. So there I am being invited to go over the fence. But that ended up being about a 3, 4, 5 year process of making that decision. So yeah, sometimes the direction in which we're called to move is fraught with a bit more anxiety and turbulence about knowing what we're leaving, but not quite sure where we're headed. So I can relate to that.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful that you paid attention to that dream. I imagine life has been pretty fulfilling for you since embracing your authentic self.
Yeah, it has been, and it brought forth a son that my wife and I were fortunate to be able to have in Columbus. So yes, he alone has been most life-giving, sure.
Awesome. Well, maybe we can back up for just a second. For folks, including myself, who don't have a deep knowledge of Jungian philosophy, what are some of the basics that we should be paying attention to? And, you know, what was it so significant that he proposed that kind of grounds his work?
Okay, if I might just go into a little bit about Jung himself, because I think his work came right out of his own personal experience. Jung was a Swiss psychiatrist. He was born and grew up around Basel, Switzerland. He was the son of a Swiss Reformed Church minister. So his father was a minister, preacher. He had two uncles who were also Swiss Reformed ministers. He grew up in a parsonage. So religion, in a certain way, was all around him. In his biography, he says he would often ask his father questions about this, questions about that. Why do we think that? Why do we presume that's the case? And his father would say to him, "You must stop asking questions. You cannot doubt, you must believe." And Jung said, at that point, I knew that my father and I were on different pages in life, because I could do nothing but ask questions. And I'll share with you, if you don't mind, an experience he had when he was 13. It was an experience where he was walking in the courtyard one sunny day right outside the Basel Cathedral. And the sun was shining and the sky was blue. And then he said he started having a terrible thought, a strange thought, a thought he should not think. So he tried to ignore the thought, suppress the thought for one day, 2 days, couldn't sleep at night, couldn't concentrate at school. And he finally decided, I guess I have to surrender to this terrible thought, whatever happens to me. So he surrendered to the thought, to the image. And the image that was coming to him was he saw God sitting on his golden throne, up in the heavens, so to speak, or in the sky, on a beautiful sunny day. And then out from beneath the throne he was sitting on, there dropped a turd, a piece of excrement. And that turd dropped down through the sky, crashed into the cathedral dome ceiling, and shattered it and knocked some of the walls asunder. Now he said, there it is. But to his surprise, he felt great relief. He felt like grace had been given to him, that he surrendered to this terrible, inappropriate thought. And he came to reflect on it, that maybe what he was encountering in his own psyche was this inevitable creative tension between the divine, the transcendent, and human institutions that try to mediate that to us. Sometimes well, sometimes perhaps not so well. But it awakened in him the importance of surrendering at times to a larger source of wisdom or guidance at work in our own being that seems to know more than we do about what would help us realize our true call or move toward wholeness. Now, on the front of his home in Küssnacht, Switzerland, he ended up having engraved a few Latin words, and the Latin words he had engraved were these: vocatus non vocatus Deus ad erit, which translated means called or not called, the God will be there. In some ways, that stood over his whole life. It was this belief, and actually that was a quote from the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, called or not called, the God will be there. And it was his belief throughout his life and his work as a psychiatrist that there is something at work in our own being, whether we want it or not, call for it or not, that is always kind of guiding us toward greater consciousness, wholeness, and realization of who we seem called to be in the world. And that ultimately distinguished his psychology a bit from that of Sigmund Freud. As you may know, Jung and Freud were colleagues for quite some time, both very instrumental in bringing forward the idea of the unconscious and unconscious factors that shape our way of being, you know, thoughts, feelings, needs, past wounds, and how they shape our way of being in the world. Freud thought all of those are to be found in what he called the subconscious or the personal unconscious, which is the repository of all of our past experiences. Jung believed that that was true, but there's another layer of the unconscious that he called the collective unconscious, which consists of factors that are innate to us. We don't learn them necessarily. They're there. It's a given reality. It's the realm of what he came to call archetypes, that I can say a little bit more about in a few minutes if you want to know more about that. But that's the place where there is an innate source of wisdom, guidance, impetus that seems to inspire, sometimes coerce, our life forward into what it might be in the world. And in my view, in that respect, and this is what attracted me to Jung's thought, he has much in common with most mystics. As you may well know, of course, that mystics tend to hold that there is something of the divine, of the transcendent, in our own experience, in the depths of our own soul. As John of the Cross said, God is the deepest center of our own being. As Thomas Merton says, when I have found my true self, I will have found God. So there's something of that in Jung's own psychology. In fact, in an essay he wrote on the psychological approach to the Trinity, where he talks about his belief in this innate orientation toward wholeness, he says, what I am describing is what in Christian parlance is known as the Holy Spirit, the breath that heals and makes whole. That's what I'm referring to.
Interesting.
So,
it as I'm listening to you, I realize that I've had some kind of core beliefs for a while, and they're very Jungian, and I didn't realize it. Like, you know, for one, I thought that we all have whatever the wisdom within us to solve our own problems. We have that capacity inherently in us. And I also believe that there is a God spirit within us that connects to one another and to the ultimate source of creation. So maybe I know more than I think I know.
I think you do. I think you know quite a bit. That's quite consistent with Jung's outlook.
So you used a couple of phrases that I'm curious if there are others that we should really be aware of when you think of Jungian psychology. You mentioned psyche, And there were a couple others. What are the basic terms that we should be familiar with when we think about Jungian psychology?
Okay, well, I'll mention a few. Of course, the term psyche. psyche is the Greek word for soul. And I think that is how Jung used that term. For him, psyche and soul are really synonymous. And the psyche consists, from a Jungian view, of the conscious part, you know, that of which we are currently aware. Like, you and I are aware that we're talking to one another. At least I see a picture of you on the screen. You see my picture on the screen. So we have some conscious awareness of that. But the larger dimension of who we are is sometimes not really immediately known to us. Like, we don't know, I certainly don't know precisely what I was doing and thinking on this date 5 years ago or 30 years ago. And yet some of what I experienced those days is in some way still carried within me. They reside within the unconscious, shall we say. It's that aspect of the psyche that carries factors that are part of who we are, but aren't always known to us. And yet maybe a dream might bring some of it forward. Now, for Jung, there's two layers of the unconscious. The personal unconscious contains all our past experiences, all the things that happened to us. And then this deeper layer, the collective unconscious, carries innate factors, aspects of what it means to be human that are with us when we come into life. And maybe I'd like to say something about just two other terms of Jung's thought. The one is the term complex. In his early work and research, Jung did a lot of work on discovering complexes and how they affect us. A complex is just an emotionally charged theme in our life. It's a theme or an issue that has an emotional charge to it. So certain situations will activate it. And it comes from what happened to us, what we learned, what we internalized for better or worse in our lives. For example, one man who did not have a great relationship with his father remembers his father saying, well, at least you are a good worker. You're a good worker. At least you're that. So this person throughout his life was a good worker, a hard worker. We might even say a compulsive worker, but would feel somehow guilty when he relaxed. So that's a complex, emotionally charged theme for him was the importance of work and the unacceptability of relaxing or not working. I think of another person who learned early on, if you can't say something nice, if you can't be nice, it's better to say nothing at all. So never express any negative thoughts, feelings, anger, or irritation. So she came into life extremely introverted, very uncomfortable with anger, her own anger, very unable to express it. That left her at a deficit in certain situations where she had to suppress what she was feeling. That's a complex. So as we come into life, you know, we pick up all kinds of messages about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. Maybe I learn I'm supposed to accommodate and please others, and I shouldn't think of myself. Now, some of those complexes that shape our way of being are helpful. They give us some guidance in life, but they're always limited. They're always limited. And sooner or later, there'll be a message from within ourselves that exposes how limited they are and how problematic we will find life if we have to rely only on that. That's when we rely upon the deeper layer of the psyche, this collective unconscious. And that's the realm of what Jung called archetypes, probably one of the more confusing words in his psychology, archetypes. But all he means by archetypes are innate, universal tendencies that show up in order to orient us toward greater wholeness. that's what they are. They're very much like instincts. You know, we have innate instincts that tell us when we're hungry, when we need rest or sleep to protect our survival. We don't decide to have that, we discover those responses in ourselves. And they protect the well-being of the organism and its livelihood. Archetypes are like that. They're sort of this psychic element, certain images, thoughts, feelings, or yearnings that show up in us to protect the well-being and also to propel us more toward wholeness. So the archetypes are essential to the whole process of feeling drawn to be who we are. And there are many archetypes, as many as there are universal situations. Just for example, let's say there's a man who's or a woman who's worked very hard, devoted an awful lot of energy to their work at this time in their life, beginning maybe to burn out. And they find themselves having a fantasy of hopping on a plane or a boat and heading out to a tropical island somewhere. That's an archetype. It's not like we choose to have a thought or a reaction. We find ourselves having it. And it's coming to balance our way of life, which from a Jungian view becomes dangerous when it gets too one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ignoring other parts of our soul that need to be honored as well. Well, archetypes is a word for these innate factors that come forward, seem to start to express themselves in our experience when we need them to point the direction of a necessary adjustment in some way. I'll say one or two things more and I'll stop. So for example, we all have something like a mother archetype, which is a way of saying we all have a need in our life for nurturance, for nourishment of various kinds, for holding and containment. That's an innate need we have. Sometimes that shows up. We find ourselves longing for that, or we'll get some kind of a maternal figure maybe showing up in a dream. It may be pointing to the fact that right now, this is an element of life that needs to be embraced more. Or we might speak of a father archetype as having to do with the need for initiative or empowerment in the world. We all need at times, want at times to head out into the world with confidence and initiative. And sometimes we need that support. We need that encouragement. So sometimes we'll get images, or we may find ourselves being drawn to a mentor figure who seems to bring what right now in our life, maybe we need more of. That's archetype. It's not like we decide, we more discover. And so from Jung's view, that's the deeper wisdom that is innate within the psyche, within the unconscious, and it fuels this process of individuation or of wholeness. And, you know, in my personal life, but also in working with other people over the years, I've discovered a large part of the work of attending to the soul, which is literally the meaning of psychotherapy, just to pay attention to what's going on in the soul,
yeah,
has to do with differentiating complex and archetype. You know, what's been in the driver's seat in my life, but now seems to be creating some difficulty. Something else is coming forward or needs to come forward that's calling for more inclusion. So let me stop there for a moment.
So let me validate something. It sounds like what I'm hearing is that we can embody multiple archetypes. And then the other thing I'm wondering about is an archetype perhaps the flip side of a stereotype? Or is it a yin and yang kind of a thing with archetypes and stereotypes? Or are they completely different?
Well, archetypes are related to stereotypes. Stereotypes are usually shaped more by complexes. You know, we learn something or are taught something about certain kinds of people. And then we project what we've been taught onto those people. So let's say we learn that authority figures are to be obeyed or they will be punitive. So without realizing it, I may project that stereotype onto all authority figures or people of different ethnic background. A lot of bias and prejudice, of course, is stereotypical, where we find ourselves projecting onto people things that we've been taught or learned about them. So that's a stereotype. Archetypes come from the deeper layer of wisdom. Oftentimes the archetype will counter the stereotype, will reveal to us its incorrectness, that it's been too much shaped by a complex, something we've learned and internalized. So I think that would be the larger difference.
Okay, thank you. So shadow is another term that I think I hear often with related to Jungian. Is that, what would you say about that?
Yes, the shadow is an archetype, as is the persona. And they're almost opposite. The persona is the mask we present to others, or I don't especially like the word mask, really. It's the way we feel we need to present ourselves to others. The face that's going to be acceptable, the face that's good, the face that they will like. It's the way of being that we prefer. It's always just an aspect of ourselves, not the totality. The shadow is in many ways everything that we're uncomfortable about ourselves. Often think parts of ourselves that we might prefer to reject, that we don't trust, that fill us with guilt, shame, or anxiety. It's the part, as Jung says in one place, it's all that we wish not to be, but in fact are also. So for example, anger could be in our shadow. We learn we're not supposed to be angry. And I think sometimes if you look at all the list of cardinal virtues and cardinal sins, you know, the sins like anger, pride, envy, jealousy, lust, sloth, they all refers to ways that taken too dualistically, you're not supposed to be. They all fall into the shadow. But the problem is that all of those responses are basic human responses. We all do get angry at times, especially, and it's a healthy emotional response to oppression or neglect or mistreatment. At times we all get tired and need to lay back a bit. At times we do feel some envy. We see something we admire in another person, which is sometimes an image to us of something unfulfilled in ourselves that we still would like to have the chance to fulfill. But some of those may initially be seen as shadow. And the problem is when we repress or suppress or push things into the shadow, we try to stay away from that, and it creates more conflict within the psyche. And in Jung's view, a very important part of consciousness, individuation, and wholeness is the willingness to embrace the shadow, at least to get closer to it. And so if I find myself getting more irritated and angry than I customarily do, it's worth finding out about that. It's worth finding out, there's something being expressed to me, something being revealed to me in that shadow energy. And if I can get closer to it, which means I have to accept it to some extent and find out what it is, there's a chance it can actually be transforming. And maybe I recognize an area of neglect that still creates pain in me and some anger in me. Or if I'm a bit envious, if I can get closer to that and say, well, what is it that apparently there's something I long for that I see other people having, but that I'm not having. I wonder what that says to me.
So I hear real opportunity in paying attention to your shadow. Are there also consequences to ignoring your shadow?
Yes, the consequence to ignoring the shadow is we tend to unconsciously act it out. And there is one great little dictum that Jung periodically mentions in his work. He says that the psychological rule is an inner situation that is not made conscious will happen on the outside as fate. So an unresolved conflict that we're ignoring will more and more inject itself into our life. And if I might just give an example, let's say somebody has a conflict between winning and losing, succeeding and failing, that they've learned that winning is always the ultimate value. Losing is terrible. Losing is shameful. Losing is a negative commentary upon yourselves. Success is good. Failure is always bad. Now, as we know, you know, we all fail sometimes. You know, we don't achieve everything we might be going for. We all lose. It's if you're not sort of okay about losing, it's pretty hard to compete comfortably at all. And so being able to accept occasional losing makes life and human interaction much more possible, much more amenable. But let's say someone never resolves that conflict. One is good, the other is bad. Now that unresolved conflict will end up getting injected into outer life. And now all of life is about avoiding losing. All of life is making sure I don't fail. And when it happens, somebody else is responsible. So when we too much resist something in the shadow, that's part of our human nature, but that we don't like, it ends up unconsciously becoming more the issue we're always battling. It becomes more our fate and makes even failure and losing more likely at times.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can see why you were drawn to this work. I mean, it's fascinating. I might imagine it must have been quite a shift from priesthood to move into this, and there are probably some things that are similar or you still carried with you.
Yes, I think in some ways I think it was an inevitable transition. And much as I valued being a priest in many ways, there were certain idealizations that I entered into priesthood with, like the idea that I could be totally available in a service to other people. That's what God wants me to do. That sounds wonderful. And so much so that I can be, I don't need a personal relationship or intimate relationship. I can forego that in order to be of service to more people. Now, those were very nice ideals, but I discovered that there were other factors within me that increasingly also had to be honored or recognized, some of my own personal needs, and a growing need and a desire for intimacy, deeper connection with persons, required a certain kind of embracing of sexuality in a more thoroughgoing way than I think as a young seminarian I was trying to do. So there's a way in which the greater wisdom within us invites us toward those less valued aspects of ourselves. So that's true. And I fortunately, when I became a priest, there was a lot of openness in the Roman Catholic Church to dialogue, debate, rediscovery of different points of view, the need to even develop dogma and teachings and not just preserve and hold on to them. But I have found that some of that openness giving way after a while, at least in my experience. So that's what began to suggest to me that I'm not sure I can continue to thrive in this context. So but being interested in about facilitating spiritual growth, awareness, consciousness, was still what appealed to me. And so I feel like it required me to make a transition out of that particular context where I could still be about that in a way that it felt more possible and in some ways more authentic for me.
Yeah, yeah. So what, as you look back on your career in this field, what's been really meaningful for you?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint any one thing. I think I would say being with people, sitting with people one on one, sometimes in a group, and just trying to help them be more present to their own experience and discover some of the transformative energies that were already at work within them, and to help them sort of name them and find a way to give expression to them in the life. I think that's been the most gratifying element of the work. And not to say that it automatically or easily happens. In some cases, there's quite a bit of turmoil and quite a bit of even what's called negative transference, where maybe the other person gets upset with me or finds me to be in the way or too much like their father or their mother. And then we have to work through some of that. But that feels meaningful to me.
Yeah. So much of what you're describing sounds like my experience as a spiritual director. Yeah. And so much aligned with our vision at the Spirituality Network of Awakening Lives. These seem so congruent and so intertwined with one another.
I think that some people have often asked me, well, do you do spiritual direction or you do Jungian work or Jungian analysis? And I'd have to say that for me, the two kind of flow into each other. And I think it's an important point to make, at least that I'd like to make, that whether or not a certain approach to psychology is quite consistent with spiritual direction depends upon whether that psychology affirms the reality of a transcendent factor. Jung even called it the transcendent function at work in the psyche, certain source of wisdom that reveals itself through our own experience. If someone works from that point of view, then the psychological approach, so to speak, is also, in my view, a spiritual approach as well. And of course, we're always looking for the symbols that speak most to a particular person and the beliefs that give life to them. But the two are quite compatible.
Yeah, yeah. You answered my one question that I had multiple times about any implications, spiritual implications of Jung's teaching. So clearly there are. I'm wondering now, can you separate spiritual from Jung's teaching, or are they so intermeshed that they're one and the same?
For me personally, I would say they are one and the same, because I see Jung's thought as very much predicated on this belief of a transcendent factor that's also at work in our being, consistent with, the Gospel of John 14, I'll give you another spirit that will be with you always because that spirit will be within you. And Paul's reference in 1 Corinthians to you are temples of the Holy Spirit who is within you. So I think it's quite compatible with Jung's point of view. I would say that sometimes where the challenge lies is, we're all operating at any time in our life with particular religious beliefs and symbols, dogmas that may speak to us. And that's fine. And I think in working with people, respecting what their symbol system is very important. At the same time, in my view, when that symbol system has worn out or starts to feel inadequate to capture the reality of the transcendent as they're now experiencing, then a certain kind of revision may be underway. And sometimes that then becomes the nature of the work. So, imagining God or speaking of God in masculine terminology alone at some point just doesn't suffice or doesn't capture the whole.
Yes. Yeah.
The notion of maybe the notion of infallibility, of someone being able to pronounce truths that are infallible and beyond question, that may not resonate with one's experience of ongoing discovery of this unknown reality we call God that we're always learning more about. So sometimes the need for revision of one's religious belief is a central part of the process. And
That's very much of the stage that I'm in right now, Dick. Since I retired from my corporate career, I've decided that I need to look at every belief that I have and hold it very gently, and to ask myself, is this something that I want to hold on to? And if not, you know, let it go gracefully. And embrace either a new way of thinking or a mystery without an answer that has, you know, yet to be revealed. And I'm finding it so liberating and so life-giving to just not hold on to everything so tightly.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great gift and necessity to recognize that the transcendent God, however we name that transcendent, is always more than we're aware of. It's still revealing itself to us as we make our way through life. And to presume that it's already resolved, everything is fixed in a certain creed or set of beliefs, would be nice, might be very comforting, but our own life experience ends up conveying to us that isn't quite so.
And there's a tension when we don't resolve that those discrepancies, and there's a lack of freedom from that as well. So as people get into deeper understanding of Jungian psychology, are there any pitfalls or dangers or things that you should that we you might caution us against? So that we don't head down the wrong path.
Well, maybe I'll just say a couple of things. I think one misunderstanding, from my view, that's often attributed to Jungian thought is the belief that Jung says that God is in the psyche or in our head, that you know, that God is just our own psyche, and that's it, God contained within, and that's reducing God down to psyche. I think that's not really true what Jung is about. He recognizes that an aspect of our psychic experience is this realm of the unknown, this larger, always larger than us, and the actual origin of that is not completely known to us, but that we do have experiences of encountering this larger wisdom and power. It's available to us in our experience. We don't control it. It often comes to us. We don't direct it. So in that sense, God is not just synonymous with a contained psyche. The soul is something, the outreach of, we don't entirely completely know, but we do have experiences. And it's important to pay attention to those. I might say one other important Jungian thought here. For Jung, the language of the unconscious is symbolic. And a symbol for Jung is just the best current possible expression of something still unknown. And that's how we encounter the unconscious. And certainly the images that come to us in waking fantasy, the images that come in our dreams are symbols. They're manifestations of something that's starting to become a bit more known, but still some largely unknown. We don't know why we're getting that particular image. I'd want to suggest that our emotions are also symbols. Emotions are never completely conscious. You know, if we're angry, we're not ever sure precisely why we're as angry as we are. We may have some hints about it, but they're also symbolic. Bodily symptoms sometimes reveal to us. So paying attention to all the various ways in which something is being made known to us symbolically, images, fantasies, dreams, emotional reactions, physical symptoms, repetitive conflicts in our life, it's as if we're encountering something that's not yet completely known or understood, but's making itself more present. And
that sounds like a whole other podcast, Dick, to go into all of that. That would sound very deep and fascinating. So where might people go to learn a little bit more about you or more about Jungian psychology? Where would you direct us?
Well, I certainly would direct you, certainly in the greater Columbus area, to the C.G. Jung Association of Central Ohio. There is a very active local Jung group there that offers seminars, book studies, lectures. The C.G. Jung Association of Central Ohio, you just Google that, it will pop up. Most cities also have a Jung Association. In Cincinnati, the Cincinnati Friends of Jung is another association. So I would certainly recommend people interested in something more to check out those sites and find other people who are interested in exploring Jung's thought and related thought more deeply. In terms of basic things to read, I'll mention just a few. A very readable intro to Jung's thought is Man and His Symbols. It's published many years ago, so the term man's not so inclusive in the original title. But Man and His Symbols by Jung, it's very readable. Or to read his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, where he really tells his own story. And that's where you kind of discover the emergence of his own way of thinking. So I mentioned those two things. And they want to contact me, they can always find my email. I think by Googling it, it's rsweeney@ameritech.net. But if you, I guess, put in Richard Sweeney in South Portland, it should show up.
Wonderful. Dick, this has been absolutely delightful. Before I wrap up, do you have any closing thoughts, anything you want to reiterate or anything that's been left unsaid?
Not that currently it comes to me. We didn't talk a great deal about dreams. That's a whole other topic unto itself, topic of how dreams bring forward what needs to be made conscious now. I'll just say that the dream is always bringing close to consciousness something that would be useful for us now in our movement toward greater wholeness, something that right now is a topic that's calling for more awareness. So that's a whole other topic unto itself.
Well, I won't put you on the spot, but I would love to talk about that further with you at some other time. I've become more fascinated with dreams. It felt like for a long time, I never recalled having dreams. And now I recall them very vividly, and I'm very intrigued by them. So I'd love to talk to you more about that at some point in the future.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again for joining me. And for our listeners, thank you for joining us today for Awakening Lives. This is one more way the Spirituality Network connects people with resources for spiritual growth and depth, regardless of faith tradition. Through education and training, spiritual direction for individuals and groups, and community programs and events. Ecumenical and interfaith, the Spirituality Network honors diversity and does not proselytize. If you wish to know more about our programming, please visit spiritualitynetwork.org, where you'll find events such as our Attachment Styles Workshop that we'll have on March 23rd, which will explore the impact on relationships. And I want to let you know that we are going to repeat our contemplative concert on June 28th. That's going to be held at Linworth United Methodist Church, and we hope you will join us for that event. If you found this podcast meaningful, please like and share with your family and friends, and join us again next month as we explore ways to awaken our lives and transform the world.